Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick here to talk about a topic near and dear to my heart tonight. And we got a great guest on. Going to talk about the Ravens defensive coordinators with Dev Panchwa. Dev, how you doing, buddy?
I am fantastic, Ken. This is one of our sweet spot passion topics, us nerding out on Ravens history and Ravens defense. So I can't, I appreciate you having me on. Actually, it's going to be a lot of fun.
There's literally no one else I can think of who's been around for the entire tenure of the Ravens. Because a lot of, you know, people, they joined in 2012 or 2014, or they, you know, they were five when the Ravens started out. And, you know, it's more of us older guard who have been around for a while. You know, I knew you from way back when that have seen the whole history unfold in front of us. And there's a lot to talk about by defensive coordinator. Let's talk about first, though, where can people find you on Twitter?
Yeah, people can find me at Dev Panchwa on Twitter. Talk about a wide variety of things. And then they can also find my work on Russell Street Report. So that's good stuff out there recently. So just message me anytime if you want to talk about defense or Ravens history or anything, really.
All right. Outstanding, Dev. Always good reads. Used to do the battle plans for years. Are you still doing that, or is somebody else got that now?
I haven't done it for a couple of seasons now. Pulled back, but last season I did a reflections piece, which ran every few weeks, talking through kind of what I saw in each of the games. So it was almost a reverse piece, actually. Mm-hmm. Whereas battle plans looked ahead at the game plan, but lately I've been focusing on some feature pieces on specific topics, and had the chance to actually work with James Ogden and Michael Crawford on a collaboration where we talked about Lamar Jackson. We've been doing some roundtables, which has been a lot of fun. And sometimes you get the chance to unpack unpack more, just like we're doing right now. Well, like this defensive discussion, it can be really fun.
All right, well, let's jump into it here. We're going to talk about the Ravens, all seven of their defensive coordinators in 25 seasons. That's a good number. They've kept their guys as long as they could. In most cases, they left for bigger and better things. Still interesting that I don't believe any Ravens defensive coordinator has ever been fired. Dean Pease left, kind of a little bit of a stigma, but Madison, I believe, resigned to go back to Michigan and coach there. So I still believe that none of them have been actually fired. They all moved on to better jobs.
It's interesting how those two situations unfolded, though. It was the closest I can think of as... maybe there's a wink-wink or some sort of conversation that was had, like, hey, maybe, you know, for Greg Madison especially, hey, going to Michigan's a good deal. Go there and part of that staff and take less pressure on as he kind of took on naturally as a defensive coordinator in the NFL.
Yeah, we'll never know really in the case of him or of Pease, but let's start at the beginning with Marvin Lewis and really talk about him. And Marvin Lewis is a strange animal in terms of his career as a defensive coordinator really evolved through a number of stages. So he came to the 96 Ravens as a defensive coordinator, and Ray Lewis was in his first season. The Ravens were decimated by injuries on defense that year. In fact, they shifted from a 4-3 base to a 3-4 base due to a number of injuries that had happened on the defensive line. They just couldn't field a 4-3 anymore in that first season. Ray Lewis, a two-down linebacker, didn't yet have the green dot. That was Eric Turner. In 1996, he didn't take it over until 97. The other thing about that 96 defense that really got me was the amount of quarter package they played. 116 snaps that with Benny Thompson, the special teams H, coming in to replace Ray Lewis on defense.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. I think and that's a nice nugget. And I didn't, thinking back to it, of all things, I think that was a precursor probably to Marvin's sensibilities, though, as a defensive coordinator, wanting that. Almost that's the chess piece to have a guy like a Benny Thompson at that point, somebody with some speed, somebody that could get lateral agility a little bit better on the field. And then the one thing, the interesting thing about for Ravens fans that are newer, think back to Eric Turner, and Ray Lewis has talked about this. That was a moment for him. He realized, I need to take that from Eric Turner, not in a bad way, not in a negative way, but it was like, I think The Rock in wrestling says something about it's time to take the brass ring. That was kind of like Ray Lewis is like, take the brass ring from Eric Turner and the passing of the torch. So that wasn't in that year, to your point, but I think it was coming, mm-hmm. Which was a cool part. And Turner was a hell of a player.
Yeah. He still holds a Ravens record that most everybody would guess is Ed Reed, but he had interceptions in 5 straight games at one point, which is still the record after all these years. That 96 defense, of course, had a lot of problems. The Ravens offense that year was really a great, almost unstoppable, no-huddle offense, but they really couldn't do it very much because the defense couldn't hold up to being back on the field.
Oh my God.
Series after series. So
it was. It's funny, Ken. I think there was a point, this was on Twitter, and there was a conversation about the Falcons. It was a discussion about this team specifically, like the 96 team. And I chimed in because somebody wanted my input in terms of history. And I'm like, just imagine being a Falcons fan like today. That's what you had with this team because they would blow every single big lead. And it was
forcefully.
It was fun in a sense, 40 point games, but yeah, to your point, it was so frustrating. And I know that Ray in particular, he had to go through his lumps when he started out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're not going to talk about all the years individually. 97 and 98 blend together a little bit for me. I mean, the defense improved in those years. 97 was the year of drafting Bulwer and Sharper, so that linebacking crew was incredibly young, and they kind of matured together. Still not great years in either of those. Honestly, the acquisition of McCrary and Siragusa returned the Ravens to a 4-3 with a lot of investment there. That was really the start of an incredible run of free agents for the Ravens in general. I mean, we think of that team as being homegrown. There are a lot of defensive draft picks in particular that were high, but Ozzie's record of signing free agents that era was just incredible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then before we joined, I was thinking back to that. And the foundation actually of the defense and I think more of the credibility really being established was Michael McCrary, that signing. Siragusa as well. But I just remember distinctly in free agency that at that point, how important it was to sign McCrary. And I forget, they signed another, or I think they're pursuing another free agent at that time, and they didn't end up signing him, and I can't remember who it was. But point is, McCrary decided to come, and it changed everything, I think. It really did, because he was like the first. It wasn't the landmark. He wasn't like Reggie White or something. Mm-hmm. But he was a mid-tier guy that had talent and seemed to be on the upswing, and all of a sudden that changed it all, and I think they got credibility and reputationally better, and it turned into a place, a good spot for veterans to go to. And I don't know, I think part of that is Ozzie's brilliance as a pitch man too.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, they had not yet, I don't believe, built the castle at that point. That was coming in about 2000.
It
was,
yeah. Yeah.
So they didn't quite have that as a recruiting inducement yet. That eventually became very powerful. But getting back to Marvin here, the tendencies to use stunts and twists really showed up in the 97 and 98 score sheets more. 96, there wasn't a lot of flexibility to play games with that unit. The 97, 98 teams stunted an unbelievable amount. I remember there's an X's and O's football game that I played when I was younger that had double twist Willie, the play in it, and it's a tackle and stunt on both sides, basically. This is they did a ton of that, not necessarily that play, but a lot of stunts and twists. If you were asked who was the Raven in history who stunted more than any other on a per play basis, at least, who would you guess?
In my head, I'm logically thinking Burnett has got to be up there, but
Yeah, it's and when I talk about the stunting player, the way I record on my score sheet, who's the over, not who's the pick man, because that
yeah,
you could get other people's, but the heaviest stunter in Ravens history, James Jones.
Yeah.
So he had 11 and a half sacks in 97 and 98 combined. Just think about what that would mean today if we all of a sudden had an interior defensive lineman with 11 and a half sacks over a 2-year period even. We'd be pretty excited.
Oh, that's a great name from back in the day. Another player that was really, really good. And I know he moved on to, I think it was Detroit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great, I mean, that's a guy that didn't stick for their, you know, ascent to the mountaintop. But yeah, he was a very integral piece of that rotation. So yeah, that's a good call out. I do remember him being very, very good. I didn't remember being that good, but
yeah.
Still, that's impressive.
They really abused him in terms of the number of snaps they had him play. The current Ravens are much more rotational about what they did in the early Lewis era, and some of it is they didn't have enough players to you know, active for each game based on some of the injuries. But Jones, in particular, in that Rams game in '96, played. It was either 90 or 91 snaps. I believe he might have missed one. And for a defensive lineman to do that, it's absurd.
So yeah, no, for sure. One quick thing just sparked my thought, though. I think that final game against Detroit in '98, where they basically formed their identity of who they would become against the run, and they ended up holding Barry Sanders to 40 yards rushing and kept him under 1500 yards. And then that was his final game in his career. And it came up the other day, I think just organically on Twitter, like, remember this happened? And it's just thinking back, I think that game. And it also, I know that they played the Vikings that year and that also got
yes.
Look attention. So there were some foundational elements defensively that people could see. And so I think the 98 season was important for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then 99, a lot of this youth is finally coming together, and it's not just the big guys, you know, the three linebackers. It's Starks and McAllister, you know, a couple of consecutive number 10 overall picks at corner. Starks developed very quickly as a rookie. McAllister developed even quicker with an interception, I think, on his fourth NFL play, but he was, you know, out there and doing things right away. And in watching the 99 games, the big thing they were talking about is how they have three great corners with Deron Jenkins. How are they going to get one off the field, you know? They ended up making that call pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's a good point, though. I mean, Deron Jenkins was a talented guy, second round pick. So, but the cool thing, and I know you talked about this or you brought this up as a precursor, but the Marvin's tendency to lean more on those heavier, leaning more on the secondary, really, but more like having numbers in those sub packages.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
that really peaked out in 2000. But the just a couple more things about the 99 team before we jump to that, because the 2000 discussion is a fun one in and of itself. The 99 team allowed only 4.1 yards per play, lowest in team history. They had that first shutout in franchise history against Cincinnati late in the year, 22-0. Great run that, to me, established the 2000 Ravens at the end of 99, where they beat Cincinnati, the Saints, Pittsburgh, and the Tennessee Titans, who would go on to lose the Super Bowl by a yard.
Yeah, they routed the Titans that year. That was the second game, and yeah, they were the hottest team. You could argue they're the hottest team to end the year and just missed the playoffs, in a sense. And I remember that was back in the days of primetime, NFL primetime, and Chris Berman was all over the Ravens, kept talking about they're coming, you know, like this team's arriving. So, you know, him and Tom Jackson, they just loved that defense.
Well, if you look back to the beginning of that year, they started with the Water Buffalo quarterback, and he went 0-2.
Yeah.
And admittedly, they started at St. Louis, who nobody thought was a good team, but that ended up being a hell of a football team that won the Super Bowl. And then they went to the Stone Age. Stoney Case was absolutely terrible. The 2-2 record that he had is a complete lie. He was utterly horrible, and they finished the year with Tony Banks, who was very good, and actually was a hell of a quarterback in 1999.
Yeah, definitely. That was a bright spot. I just recall, and it was back in those times too, when Tony Banks was a guy that everybody knew had talent. It wasn't like they did pick him up. It was back in the trash heap. The whole Billick offense was, you know, dubbed the trash heap players, or trash heap offense. But Banks was the one out of that group that had legit talent, had a fumbling issue. Mm-hmm. Coming from the Rams, and I think it was a reclamation project that similar like a Ryan Tannehill today, like to me, like kind of maybe Ryan Tannehill was more established, had more proven production, but regardless, it was I think a bright spot, like for some hope that this guy could actually turn into a really good quarterback.
Right. And exciting, certainly, that they went into 2000. One of the things that was true in 99 of Lewis is that he was a base or dime guy. And we've had a couple different variations of this. The base or dime, what I mean is that they rarely go to the nickel. Even when you would normally consider yourself forced, they might go to the dime instead. Relatively small sliver of nickel snaps in there. And Mike Nolan was very similar. We'll get to him in a minute. But Lewis, particularly in 99, was a big base or dime guy. 4 or 6 defensive backs, you don't go in between. And it's interesting what he became in 2000, because obviously 2000, a magical season. It's a season a lot of Ravens fans remember as their first good memories of the team, even though there was some good memories from the 90s. But 2000, everything changed. Everything worked. A 4-3 defense that was absolutely dominant, and certainly the starting 11, their names are still all known today. But the thing that I find interesting is that's the 5th, 6th, and 7th defensive backs who played some of the highest leverage snaps of the year, who were largely forgotten today.
Yeah, we Bailey, Trapp, Corey Harris, they were supplanting Starks, McAllister, but they didn't do the substitutions as much as we see with Wink, right? Like this was more those guys all played together, and I think part of it was Ray that really enabled them to do that, because if you think about it, it's kind of revolutionary. He had this inside linebacker that you entrusted to cover the entire field, sideline to sideline. He wasn't, they didn't use, I don't think, Sharper as often in that role.
That's correct.
To play along with them. So this is like, I think, groundbreaking stuff. And that made it easier for Marvin to use all of these defensive backs at once. And one other thing I would point out too is rotationally in the front, I think they used 8-9 guys. They had Larry Webster was on suspension, ended up coming back that year. They had Jelly, they had Lionel Dalton, they had Martin Chase, they had Keith Washington. So these guys all like aren't household names necessarily, but they were all integral to having this heavy, heavy defensive front rotation that was just. He had waves of defenders in the back end and on the front end.
Yeah, absolutely. And that the 2001 defensive line in particular is one of the deepest in NFL history, because it had all the basic four of the 2000 group, but had Adalis Thomas. And yes, he'd only played about 10 snaps, but he started off as a defensive tackle, or, you know, maybe a 5-tech from Ozzie's perspective as to where he would have ended up. Yep. But you know, really could have been used as a 3 that year. Some, I mean, the thing about the 2000 Ravens, so Kelly Gregg was a situational pass rusher in 2001. You know, they had Still Dalton, and there's one other that I'm forgetting that they had, but they really had 8 defensive linemen getting a significant. It's Webster.
Yeah, Webster was the guy. Webster played a lot more in that year. He did.
Yeah.
So it was a embarrassment of riches in terms of the talent mm-hmm. they had, and Webster's a guy that could have started on most of the teams, half the team, something like that in the league.
Yeah, definitely an exciting player. You talked about Ray being the thing in the player who made a lot of these heavy DB packages work. So unusual. It just doesn't happen today. They didn't play a 4-0-7 quarter, which is a kind of a more normal situation where you take all your inside linebackers out of the game.
Right.
You have 4 linemen or 4 guys who are designated as pass rushers clearly in the play, and you have 7 defensive backs behind them. And that's kind of what the Ravens would do today to try and get 7 DBs or even 6 on the field. But with The Ray thing, they're playing a 31 dime. They only had three guys lining up in as fixed pieces at the line of scrimmage, with Rob Burnett kicking inside to play a slant nose to really oddball kind of look to the formation. And then Ray had a kind of a roving ability to rush the passer from multiple spots. And they would also, of course, do what Wink does today, which is rush some of those defensive backs at will as well.
Yeah, and I think part of it was interesting too is they had that, and obviously they had the best run defense in history, but they did a lot of this with those guys on the field. It wasn't, from what I remember, when they would even be in their sub packages, or those sub packages didn't have to come out on third and long. I mean, I think they played a good amount of that in between situations too. So, and they were like, James Trapp could play the run. Robert Bailey could. Those guys were hitters. They were thumpers. They would come up and hit you, and that was the cool part as well.
Yeah, there was a lot less forced nickel in that day because there just wasn't as much 11 personnel in the whole league. People hadn't figured out yet that they really wanted to run out of 11 to spread the defense out to do it. So there wasn't as much forced nickel. They played a lot of that quarter package. They played on third and four, third and five, and that really was revolutionary, that people thought, hey, you know, you need bigger players on the field to defend against the possibility of running for a first down. And if you had, you know, Lamar Jackson and John Harbaugh on the other side making decisions about going for it on two plays at that point, maybe they'd have been right. But when you have Vinny Testaverde as, you know, one of the opposing quarterbacks you're facing, and that's a great choice.
That's a good point too. So it was a different day that made it easier, I think, to stay in some of these packages, and Marvin was a step ahead. That was pretty clear too.
Yeah, definitely. All defensive coordinators will say this, that you build your defense to fit your players and not the other way around. You don't fit your players as square pegs into these different defenses. And Marvin, really more than any Ravens defensive coordinator, I think that's very clear the way it was done. That he looked around and said, here's the assets I've got. I'm going to figure out the best way to use them. Pees would be maybe the second most in that category of really doing that. We'll talk about some more of this as we go. So 2001 was Marvin's final season. And the big change for 2001, you mentioned Jamie Sharper, is that they used him in this new 32 dime package. So they got away from a 4-1 dime, which is the most common, still prevalent in the NFL today. You only have one inside linebacker on the field. Your second inside linebacker is a dime back, a weak side linebacker. And then you have four guys at the line of scrimmage. But this team, they broke the rules and went to a 32 dime. The only other team I've really heard of doing that is Dallas.
Gotcha, yeah. And then you said the three, it was a slanted Burnett on the slant. I think, was it McCrary that got hurt? One of those two guys got hurt.
Yeah.
So that affected some of the, and I know Bulwer ended up getting the snaps at defensive end. So I think I might have had it mixed up in terms of who got hurt. But again, Marvin was able to adjust. And I think that was, and seeing Sharper get more responsibility. He was really showing himself in the playoff run year prior, obviously during the 2000 playoff.
Yeah.
He was able to make an impact in the passing game against the Giants, against the Raiders. He had that pick against the Raiders. So maybe that lended to him getting more responsibilities in passing situations.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt about it. He also, going down the stretch in that weird game in Arizona, that they were still in hopes of winning the division. It was probably not going to happen, but they went to Arizona, and he had a huge interception to put that game away when it was only 13-7.
Yeah, I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a big pick. He's a much more talented player than we remember him. A lot of people who saw the early Sharper years really think of him as a two-down thumper exclusively, and he was really a lot more than that by the time he left the Ravens.
And I think what he really did well, Ken, was he understood his assignment. He had the best proper zone, proper drop technique. Mm-hmm. So whatever he might have lacked in terms of physical foot speed, again, this is going back in those days, though. So like we're going back to the right before Lavon Kirkland, like, who was a 280-pound inside linebacker. So teams did more of that, and they would take some chances with those guys in coverage. But I think Sharper still had, like, relatively decent, you know, agility, lateral quickness. That being said, yeah, I think part of he was crafty, he was smart, he was in the right spot, he was he did those things so well that it short I think covered up any physical limitation.
Yeah. Sad to see him go. Very classy dude. Put a full page ad in the paper when he left to go to the Texans. And
I remember that. I think and they were really close to keeping him too. They did keep him. It was going to be gone the year prior, and that year 2001, and they couldn't keep him. So it was a tough blow. I remember that one. It was very tough.
Yeah, so after 2001, of course, they had the purge, and Marvin Lewis had his famous single year with the Redskins. So even though he didn't leave to be a head coach, he effectively did. They knew he was going to be a head coach. Thought it would happen after 2000. It didn't. It still didn't happen after 2001, but at least he got a high-paying job taking some money from Dan Snyder.
Yeah.
And then went off to be head coach of the Bengals, of course, in 2003.
Yeah, that was a massive transition on all fronts. When you're talking about personnel, talking about the coach, talking about the team, and I think it did sting at the time when he left to be defensive coordinator in Washington. Obviously, you got the assistant coach position, so it was still technically a raise and a bump up for him. But I think a lot of people weren't thrilled. Because it was Washington as well, right? So it was a little bit of salt in the wound. But that 2002 team was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I just remember, and Mike Nolan, there was not a whole lot known in terms of what he was going to bring to the table. But I mean, he did reset the 3-4, and I remember there was some controversy with that too, because especially Ray wasn't thrilled with that switch. So then what was interesting, and I thought about it before this joining with you, I was like trying to think through the anecdotes, but one of the anecdotes that's cool for the listeners is Kelly Gregg, who turned into one of the best defensive linemen for the Ravens, but it wasn't the thought back then, right? So they plugged him in at nose tackle, and it looked so risky on paper that you have this 300-pound, I think, barely
undersized. Yeah, tackle.
They went from these two Goliaths to him, and then you have Ray playing behind him. So the whole thing just didn't look. It looked like you said, the square peg into the round hole versus the other way around. Are you playing to your strengths? And you have Ray, who's going to now be unprotected more and have another linebacker next. So it was an incredibly risky, I feel like, move and transition for Nolan.
And extremely well done. I mean, because he had a number of players leaving then. Burnett, Siragusa, Stark, Sharper, Adams, and Corey Harris, they all left the team. There's others too, but those are big ones. And they made room, though, for Ed Reed, Adalis Thomas, Kelly Gregg, Weaver, Demps, who was pretty good there for a few years for the Ravens. It's a lot of room was made for talent. That's why I always say the good teams aren't afraid to let some good players go. They're not afraid of change. It happens to everybody. I think I left Sharper out of there, too, didn't I? Because they lost. No, I didn't. I had him in there. But anyway.
Yeah, they lost, every guy, except for Bulwer, Ray, McAllister, and McCrary. Yeah. And I think McCrary was also on his last leg. So, I mean, really was incredible to see. To your point, they restocked and didn't expect a whole too much from that 2002 group. One of the guys that I wanted to call out was Bernardo Harris, who so that was when did Ray get hurt that year? I think he got hurt that year.
No, too. He was hurt for a while. Yeah. And that was part of the reason why that season was so special. But he was off to probably one of his greatest seasons in early 2002. And he had, I think it was that Monday night game at Cleveland, or maybe it was a Sunday night game, but it was a national television game where he fell on the football field. Mm-hmm. And he's having one of the great games of his career at that point. They put him up 20-0. And I think they held on to win that game narrowly, but I don't remember what the score was, like 23-16 or something, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. They blew the lead, but no, to your point, he was having this back-to-back night performance, iconic performances, the stuff of legends, like your butt kisses and your Singletaries and all these other guys, right? Like you're seeing it unfold. And this is coming after, you know, a couple of years back, he was Super Bowl MVP, defensive player of the year. So it's not like he's never looked like that before. But I think he took it to another level. He did get hurt. Bernardo Harris was a guy they picked up, a veteran from the Packers who was very solid for them. And I think kind of was another one of these typical, like a LJ Fort now today. Like if you pick up, they picked up LJ Fort, he was able to solidify the defense. So they did, they had some nice, I think, veteran additions here and there to supplant and kind of backfill some of these players.
The teams really have known, the Ravens have really known what they're looking for in terms of a linebacker, in terms of specialized skills. And I've always been impressed with their ability to rebuild that on the fly, both during a season, you know, that sort of on the fly, or during the offseason, when, whenever they, you know, can pick up Bart Scott for nothing, can pick up Jameel McClain or Ellerby or other players for nothing. And by the time the players, those players leave the Ravens, it's like, oh, how can we afford to lose them? And then they go somewhere else and they're not all that impressive.
Oh, I mean, that's a great point too. Bart's, I mean, it goes a lot of different directions. The UDFAs are undrafted guys that they plug in and they just have this incredible trust in their system. And in that season too, Bart Scott's another guy. And
yeah,
all these guys, McClain, I think, you know, McClain.
Oh, wait.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was later. But yeah, anyway, they had a pipeline and they just kept pumping these guys out. And it was incredible, especially in a season where they couldn't fully depend on Ray Lewis.
Right. Yeah, it was a fun season to watch. I have fond memories of it, and then I have a very unfond memory of them giving up the big drive to Cleveland that basically put them out of the playoffs. They did have a slight chance to get it the next week, but if they beat Cleveland, they would have been, you know, in their own hands or destiny in their own hands. A bummer of a thing, but getting back to Mike Nolan there, he was another base or dime guy, very little nickel, and a little bit like Marvin in that regard, or at least the early Marvin years. But he did some things that were very interesting with regard to that. His dime was very much a three safety look. So it's the dime we think of today as being the dime they put on the field. And he did have other things he liked to do with players like Bart Scott and whatnot, being a third down linebacker. Not tremendously aggressive with the pass rush. And that 2002 team immediately matured in 2003.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, well, the pass rush part, I was trying to think back, and I think he did amp it up a bit more than Marvin. But yeah, like to your point, I don't remember and I don't recall a heavy dose of blitz action or wild, wild west style like Rex. I mean, so he dialed it up here and there, but it was, I think, very strategic. It was situational based. And so, yeah, and I think with Suggs and Boulware, you might not have to do that as much because you've got two incredible edge rushers. So I think he played to the strengths of those guys and got a lot out of them. So, no, I mean, and I think that was part of it. And then when you think back to some of the other facets was, I think, development of Adrian Hartwell. So they just had the stock. All the guys that they drafted, it seemed like they all played right away. They had to. They had no other choice. But the crazy part is that they all played reasonably well as starters, and some of them took it up even more. Obviously, Ed Reed and Suggs are some of the best ever, but even your Edgerton Hartwells, Gary Baxters, those guys, Will Demps, like they all were pretty solid starters.
Right. I mean, you know, Will Demps, a UDFA that immediately was a starter, was one of the good stories of that era. It's a fascinating crew, that's for sure. And the Nolan era, you know, that sharp contrast from what really is one of the worst defenses in Ravens history of the 2000 to the present time was that 2002 team. And it was really nice to see them so quickly back on top, Reed being probably the biggest single factor of that, but you know, the health of Ray Lewis and all the other players coming around quickly. Adalis Thomas, a little bit forgotten from that era, just how much his jump in play between 02 and 03, and 01 and 02, in fact, really made him a critical part of that defense.
Yeah, that's a good point. He started to really take off. Another example of someone their pipeline that drafted and developed, but his opportunity it was quicker than maybe it might have been because of the fact that they had to plug guys in. So he took advantage of that. I thought Marquise Douglas is another guy that
he's the 0-1 guy I didn't think of. He's the
O-1. Right. So he played a lot in 0-1, I think, and rotationally, and then he really took off. That 3-4, Anthony Weaver was part of the 3-4. So they really actually, it was so interesting. Again, you go from this 4-3 group and then the 3-4, and then they started mapping these players, and I think they all fit really well. It was it was a front that I think was a little bit under, in the grand scheme of things, maybe we underrate a little bit, because obviously Kelly Gregg, you know, he turned into a monster in those tackles. So 100 tackles, what was it? 100 tackles? So something, he was just so good. But these guys were, what were they, Buddy Lee group?
Yeah.
I think Billy called them. So that was the mentality. They just weren't these, it wasn't Casey Hampton, or like these big, you know, Ted Washington, Casey Hampton, like you think of these big guys at the time, but this group was so good with their technique and their leverage and their pad level.
Yeah, he was really kind of a rare one gap nose tackle kind of player. He's not a traditional two capper, pure zero guy kind of thing, like we think of some of these other big names you're talking about, like Hampton and Ted Washington, who was around the NFL for many, many years. But Gregg was just a ridiculously productive tackler for a defensive lineman. You look at Siragusa or Adams and their tackle totals, they're nowhere near the kind of tackle totals that Gregg had. And that's just, it's a different kind of player. And I, you know, people out there who like their two gap noses will always say, but no, he's got a different role. He's not a two gap. Well, Kelly Gregg could handle two gaps a lot with his penetration. He would push people into other gaps. So I just, I loved him as a player. I love Nada even more, but I really did love Gregg.
Yeah, and again, you have to love the fact that that was something that Nolan really understood. Nolan really had the foresight on that one, and give him credit. But Gregg was a catalyst up front, and then again, they got the most out of that front. And you wouldn't look at them and think that this is this imposing front, but they actually were very productive. They had a good ability to rush the passer, like you said, get penetration, quick penetration, run, a lot of good things.
As we get closer, we're going to need to go a little faster here, because I know we're working on a little bit of a time limit here. But 2004, the Ravens again with Nolan in his final year. Really, that defense carried that team. Obviously, it had a lot of problems. Really, all over the offense. Jamal Lewis was not the player he was in 2003. The offensive line was not as good. Just a whole bevy of problems. But that secondary was outstanding. Reed had one of his best years, and was the defensive player of the year, of course. And then Nolan, that was the year he really started to ratchet it up with more pass rushes. And I think that might have been the first year the Ravens had 40% 5+ rushing the quarterback. They hadn't done it, to my knowledge. I have to go back and check. I've got the plays charted, of course, but I have to go back and check to see if they ever did it during the Lewis era that I'm just forgetting, like maybe in 99 or something. But he was generally a dial of pressure on, just get it exactly to the boiling level, or kind of boil the frog in terms of the quarterback. Whereas Nolan was a little more aggressive, but none of them were anything compared to our next guy.
No, not at all.
You want to introduce Rex?
Oh yeah. So Rex, can you say to me, I think Rex had that mentality going to his father, Buddy Ryan, who's one of the great defensive minds ever, and just carried that over as pressure breaks pipes. And Ryan, Buddy Ryan, we know was the architect of the Chicago Bears 46 defense. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about Rex is that he did so many unconventional things, and that included, I think, bringing the 46 in bits and pieces to this Ravens defense. They did quite a bit of that, use the bare front, but I just think Rex's time here, and you talk about Adelis Thomas for the sake of it, like what he unlocked with him. Everything that we talked about with Nolan, right? I don't want to discount Nolan. I feel like Nolan's like the perfect example of like he was the right guy at that time. Then Rex was really the right guy at the next level to take like Adelis in the direction, or even Ed Reed. Like where can we move Ed? Like every single place, right? It's just a wild mastermind.
Yeah.
The only way to think of it.
Yeah. The best example I can come up with this, and I've talked with this occasionally on the show, is that in 2005, the Ravens played 265 snaps with only three defensive backs on the field.
Right.
Three defensive backs. Now, how do they do that? Well, they effectively moved Adelis Thomas to strong safety. Now, that wasn't his stated position. They always called him an outside linebacker or a defensive lineman even sometimes. But what he was really doing is taking that tight end, even if split, without fear down the field. And he was one of the few guys who had the athleticism to do that. The Ravens also had another good coverage asset in Bart Scott, who was just coming into his own in 2005. He played a little bit going back, but Bart Scott played a fair amount as a rookie. Then he didn't play very much at all during 2003. In his second year, which is a little strange, but he came back as a coverage asset in 2005, and the Ravens really needed him. The secondary was all down. I mean, everybody was down. Reed missed a significant amount of time. Sanders was there playing much more than he probably should have, but you know, still pretty good. McAllister and Roll each missed time that season, so very hard for that team to find enough bodies in the secondary, and Ryan still found a way to cover for it.
That's where the difference was when you're talking about the transition, because he now three defensive backs is obviously not ideal, but I think he just had this incredible belief in the ability to influence the quarterback with pressure, right? And this was also for me, Ken, battle plans for the sake of it. Like when I was doing battle plans with Rex, I would always think of the way he would his fronts, right? Like his pre-snap fronts.
Mm-hmm.
Now they would morph and change on the fly. Yeah. And you saw that, like you'll show an overload. An overload for the listeners is, you know, you'll have the line, two, three linebackers, however many linebackers on one side of the formation, whether it's on the weak side or strong side, and you'll show those guys coming on that side, and then inevitably they'll go drop into coverage and they'll come from the opposite side. So that was like a lot of the gamesmanship and bluffing the blitz or not showing it. So
yeah.
Ultimately he just didn't have any clue what he was doing. And most of the quarterbacks not named Peyton Manning couldn't deal with it.
Yeah, Manning was in a lot of ways his Achilles heel. Yep. But if you look at that era, you definitely had I want to go back to the first point you made, which was about the amoeba fronts. You had more pre-snap movement with Ryan than with any other defensive coordinator. I think what the Ravens have adopted more with the coaches since is the willingness to show and simulate pressure, but show everybody at the line of scrimmage. Go ahead and show them eight. Let them figure it out. And Ryan was more likely to do these zone blitzes where somebody was coming from level two, but he would also fearlessly drop linemen into level two to try and do that more than anybody has. Even Wink, who does it kind of a lot, and we saw it on the big play by Calais Campbell, the first big play of this last year with the interception that he tipped and Humphrey got it against Cleveland. You know, they just don't do that as much anymore. But Kelly Gregg would drop into coverage a fair amount, and you know, so would other defensive linemen.
Yeah, Nada did it a lot too. I mean, saw the picks that he's had a couple picks to his name, and you're right, that was the risk. I mean, again, as a risk taker or gambler, what do you want to call it? He didn't really care. Mm-hmm. He was very confident in his players. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong, because I'm not, I mean, as much as I go back to the Ravens history, I don't go as far back to the Bears 86 and 85 defenses, but I think their defense alignment also did some of that, like where they would drop and Buddy Ryan would have them drop. So that was baked into the core philosophy that anybody could rush and anybody could drop.
Right. I mean, it's, you always want the most of that that you can have. And realistically, there is a limit. I think Martindale has done a better job probably than Ryan even of figuring out how to do that. But the other thing that is so good that they do so well today, and maybe this is a place where Ryan was a step behind in the evolution, or he was ahead of the curve for his time, but the general knowledge of the thing has gone further, is taking lateral movement from those linemen is how they can really help you. They can't help you as much dropping to a specific point in a zone. There, they're heavily disadvantaged and they get a crosser. The quarterback knows how to throw against them more easily. But if you move them laterally, especially if they're undercutting a slant or a crosser coming from the other side of the field, they have tremendous value. Sometimes they even just have value to hit that player because he's within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage.
Right.
But you definitely have an ability to undercut that player as well. And the good ones and the good defensive coordinators can really teach them where to be. Absolutely fantastic at making use of that now.
Yeah, no, for sure. So he had the creativity was there, I think.
All right, let's keep going here. I'm sorry. I don't want to overdo this in terms of time. To 2006, the Ravens had 60 sacks. Incredibly, they dropped to only 43% blitzes in 2006. So they were doing a lot of that with their secondary, taking their time. Doing a lot of that was not numbers-based. This was Ryan's first deep dive into scheme-based blitzing, which means he had a lot of overload blitzes he would bring, but he would still be rushing only four. And they were very successful at getting home with that. And to have weapons like Bart Scott in 2006, who had 9 sacks, I think, or 9.5, and Dallas Thomas, who was over there with a similar total, having his best year, really made a lot of the fluidity that we see now today with Judon and Bowser playing together, outside linebackers who either one can drop to cover, and either one can be used to rush from level two or from level one.
Yeah, no, exactly. Those guys were super chess pieces, and you still had Suggs as well, so that's another chess piece. So you can imagine
Trevor Price,
right? Price on the inside, outside. I mean, it's just the amount of versatility, and I think, like, we keep talking about the similarities to now with Wink, and there's a lot of that, right? So he wants guys that can play three or four different spots. So that's what Rex was able to do with the personnel. And it's a credit to Rex though, too, because sometimes you might think a player is boxed in to a certain level, I guess, to a certain area, territory, whatever, because, you know, maybe they are just a two down player, or maybe they just only play on rundowns. And he unlocked or really expanded, like you said, Bart Scott, I think, tremendously in all facets. But even, I mean, as a pass rusher, I think that was like, it was like he was unstoppable.
Yes.
He'd come up in a blitz. Like, he would run over the running back or whoever, right? He would get to his spot.
Yeah, he had that quickness, particularly in that year in 06, to cross very effectively. A lot of cross blitzes for the Ravens that year. So if you think of what a cross blitz is, sometimes it's two guys coming from level two, but all it really has to be is one guy coming from level two who crosses a gap or two, and that messes up the offensive line in terms of their adjustments to try and get that guy blocked up and the guy at the line of scrimmage who's occupying people. So I generally don't regard those as stunts. Some people might think of them that way, but they're really cross blitzes, and they they show up a fair amount in the Ryan defense of 06. I do think of Ryan as being a heavy user of defensive backs, but he was definitely much less so than Marvin Lewis. He only had 75 snaps of dime in 2006, and they had a certifiably great dime back on that team in Jerome Sapp.
Yeah, they did. He's a good. That's a good name when we're thinking about some of those role players or like these supporting players that really get lost in the shuffle because of the big names that the Ravens have had in their history. But he was really good that year. And Corey Ivey was very good too. I think part of that same defense, right? So I mean, he had again, and this is another example of Corey Ivey's a guy that he really looked at and he said, all right, well, he can fill that role.
It could be the nickel. I mean, having that belief in Ivy is incredible.
Yeah.
And I mean, then Ivy actually moved to the outside after that when they really needed him 07.
Right. So it was, again, a reflection of Rex's ability to, I think, just kind of, I think there was some of that Belichick aspects of being like, I know the strengths of this player. I'm going to put him in those positions to succeed, but also having the confidence in those players, and they paid off.
Yeah, it's good. Certainly confidence and scheme. I want to jump ahead. I think people know how the 2006 season ended. Not a nice day for any of us. Probably about as depressed as I've ever been about a game of football to lose that game to the Colts. But the 2007 defense came back. A good defensive unit. And, you know, I think of the 05 and 07 as being, you know, two really troubled teams in terms of injuries. That 07 defense was the street of dying men in the secondary. They just, everybody went down. Willie Gaston ended up starting, you know, off the street for the Ravens for a game. So they had a lot of trouble keeping the defense together, and yet the defense remained the stronger of the units by far. And Billick was really losing the clubhouse at that point.
Oh yeah, that was a disaster. Everything New England the loss to New England the year. I mean, that year New England was going for. They ended up being undefeated and lost the Super Bowl, but that was the straw that broke the camel's back, I think. Because they not so much that game wasn't the problem. I think it was just the whole the aftermath of that game, and then they lost the lead, and then they ended up having all those penalties. If fans remember that one, I think Billick, he lost the locker room, the lack of discipline. They were the most penalized team that year in the league. So there was a lot of things there that showed, I think, that they needed to go in a different direction. Obviously,
so 08. Comes along, and the Ravens, Rex has his last year with the Ravens. He only was there 4 years. It was the best ever year for the Ravens in terms of defensive DVOA. So if you're looking at the Football Outsiders stat and how they're really measures how they're winning individual plays, they were as good as they've ever been, including 2000, 2006, all the great Ravens defenses. DVOA says that one's the best. Ray Lewis had comments about Rex really being the head coach of that team. He was very outspoken when he left to go to New York to be the head coach that, you know, maybe they got the wrong guy.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing to say at that point in time. I mean, Harbaugh walked into a situation, to his credit, I think, in which you had two very strong coordinators, guys that could have been head coaches. I mean, I know Cam Cameron's a guy that's been, and we're talking about defense. I just want to shift quickly to Cam Cameron. Just his he had a pedigree coming in. Like he could have been a head coach as well. And I think that was there, potentially there. So and then Rex on the other side. So I understood the sentiment. It's just one of those things where, you know, Ray at times would get, I think, say some things that you shouldn't say out to the world or in the, you know, to the media, but that was one of those things where they were very fortunate to have Rex for another year. I know that there was quite a bit of buzz for him to get a head coaching job after 2007. That didn't happen. This was actually one of my favorite defenses that they've had, partly because of the secondary. Now, to your point, they still, I think, they had a better secondary than they did in 2007 in terms of like health and all that. But if you look at the 2008 secondary, I mean, they got a lot of mileage out of Fabian Washington, who was kind of like just, you know, a good starting cornerback in the league, nothing special. Samari Roll was still a good player, not the Samari Roll that he was in his prime. And then they had Frank Walker, who played a lot. I mean, they kind of had a very, I'd say like a very, I don't know. It wasn't the secondary. It wasn't like the secondary that we know and love today for that sake. Like,
well, they had Ed Reed.
I'm sorry?
They had Ed Reed, of course, who was his best year ever.
For sure. And then Jim Leonard. They had a good player. Again, I don't want to knock it. They had talent in that secondary, but I think what was just cool to watch, like Rex orchestrate things with that group. And one of the more, I think he got a lot out of that group, in my opinion.
They also, I agree too, but they sat down Chris McAllister, which was a bold move at the time. They sat him down at Miami, played like six dime snaps or some such, but he was off the field. And that was pretty much it. He really didn't play again as a starter, I don't believe. If he did, it was because of injury. They made that move at that time. I remember, thinking, why is this happening? What am I missing about this that's different? Because McAllister had a checkered past in terms of his off-field behavior with the Ravens, most notably that 2003 game he missed at San Diego for reasons that have never been fully disclosed, I don't believe. But he was sent home early on the plane. Do you remember that?
Depending on who you talk to, he was seen quite a bit out in the night scene. Yeah. Of Baltimore's, illustrious like places to hang out, whether it's Fells or Federal Hill. I don't remember which one, Canton. So that's not anything I've seen, but people have talked about that.
You've given him a lot of credit, but he's well known for having the designated parking spot at Scores.
Okay, well, there's that too. So yeah. Plenty of stories that I think they're not made up. But you're right. I remember that. And then he was, he ended up getting benched, and then everything just happened so immediately, so quickly. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think, an indication of how things were going to be different under Harbaugh.
Yeah. And it'd be interesting if that was actually a headbutting moment for Ryan and Harbaugh. But to his credit, I mean, Harbaugh didn't say that screw up Harbaugh took my best player away or anything like that. He let it happen. He worked with it, whether he agreed with it or not, which is the right thing to do, and an impressive part. Anyway, you mentioned Jim Leonard. Jim Leonard is the only guy to take the green dot away from Ray Lewis. So when Ray Lewis was playing in the 08 playoffs, you can actually see the pictures, but Jim Leonard's got the green dot for those three playoff games, turned in one of the greatest series of playoff games ever by a Ravens defender while he was also taking off the green dot. That the Tennessee game in particular, he really was a one-man wrecking crew in terms of winning that game.
Yeah, he was a smart player, savvy, understood. That says everything when you're saying that he took the green dot. And then mm-hmm. I think it was reflected in the trust that Rex had in him. And obviously, he took Jim with him to the Jets. Yeah. So, yeah, he was a critical piece. Kind of reminds me of Eric Weddle before Eric Weddle. In that sense, like what he represented, at least. I mean, that Weddle was a good player even back then, and more like what he was for that Ravens defense.
So we mentioned Rex left for the Jets again, the head coaching job, immediately took Bart Scott, very famously, just a few minutes after the deadline to, or the starting point where you could talk to free agents. He showed up in his SUV to take Bart up to New York for a visit. So very quickly took those guys, and they both became defensive signal caller for a period of time for Rex. The next guy is someone who is largely forgotten and was a fair enough defensive coordinator, Greg Madison. The thing I remember him for is being lukewarm in a lot of categories, that he only played 9% dime and quarter snaps. So he's not an extreme, let's respond to this with a heavy set of defensive backs and try and drop people or even use their flexibility. And he also only rushed 35.3% 5+ in 2009. So it's not like he was a heavy blitzing guy. Although, by the way, 35.3 is probably right in the middle of the league somewhere, maybe even above average. But for the Ravens, it's low.
That's just it. I remember the blitzes, and they were very unsophisticated blitzes. So you went from Rex to Madison, and it's like going from, like, I'm trying to think of an analogy, like Leonardo DiCaprio in one part one of the movie, and then the next sequel is like a B-level actor, right, or something like that. And it's just, it was a big come down. But and then a lot of the schemes, but they're very vanilla schemes. And I remember that Patriots playoff game, and right before the game, I think it was right before the game, there were some discussions about the fact that their scheme was kind of like predictable. You could see the blitz coming a mile away because they were tipping it. They were just, the blitzers would stand there, show blitz, and they would come. And that was about it. So I think at that point, Ray was pretty much the coordinator, had stated that the key would be that they would need to not show that they were coming until 5 seconds before, and then they would come. So there was a little bit of the timing of the blitz and like not necessarily giving it away as early. And I think they made some adjustments with Greg, and obviously at that point, give Greg Madison credit because he had no ego. Mm-hmm. But that, there was some of that where I just don't think he was the right. He was okay. Like you said, they got where they got. I don't think it would have changed a whole lot not having him as the coordinator, but he also was very underwhelming ultimately.
Yeah, the 09 and 10 teams were both very good. There's no question about that. The 09 team, I think, was the best of the five-year period, despite the fact they only went 9-7. I think was still the best offensive line, to be sure, and that the Ravens have really ever had. And it is a credit that they did what they could there. Madison, certainly there's nothing that really makes him distinctive. He went back to Michigan, had a good career there for 8 more seasons, and he'd been at Notre Dame in Michigan before. So, obviously been at some big-time programs. There's just nothing wrong with him as a coordinator. It's not like the Ravens lost a lot with him, but you're right that there were things said. People missed Rex, obviously, and really – liked playing in his system more.
Yeah, that's just it. I think Madison held the fort or kept it going, right? But there wasn't anything more to it. He kind of did what he could. And ultimately, I think, let's be honest, I think this was, one of those things where Harbaugh kind of settled and didn't push the envelope with this particular DC.
It's interesting because Harbaugh later is really – his imprints are all over the DC OC choices that are made. But I would agree that I'm not convinced this is at the same level there. It is a Michigan guy, so maybe that connection was there, but it was what it was. Well, thanks, Dev. That's some great stuff. And I realize this was probably going to run too long, and it's been a great walk down memory lane. I don't want to make this shorter, but let's make sure we get back tomorrow night for the last three defensive coordinators, Chuck Pagano, Dean Pease, and, of course, Wink Martindale. Lots of stuff to say about those three. And it's been great having you on, Dev. We'll talk to you tomorrow night.